it's an emergent area of interest for a lot of people, and I think it's so ingrained in our daily life.
One way you can do that with polytrained athletes is take them to
those tiny babies.
And I guess for every day when I'm working with patients,
we expect a baby to look like.
It is a topic which is often highly emotive.
Think.
This is Think Help on 2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome to Think Health, where we cultivate and articulate the best in new health research. I'm Ellen Liebeder and you're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. Today on the program, a new trial to reduce drug errors in paediatric wards.
We've looked at the process of medication administration, and you know, from the time the drug is prescribed to the child gets it, there's something like 50 different steps. So there's opportunities all the way along there to break that sequence.
And chronic lower back pain and its effect on psychological well-being. But first on the show, imagine you're watching a rugby game. One of the players snatches the ball from the opposite team and is sprinting to score a try. But before that player makes it to the try line, they smash their head into another player, dropping the ball. The player then jumps back up and continues on with the game. There are a lot of risks when playing contact sport, but one that goes unnoticed is the cumulative effect of concussion. We routinely see sports players shake off a head collision, but repetitive exposure to this type of injury can do some serious damage. Jake Morecambe has more.
A lot of people think concussion, they have to be knocked out or unconscious. But they don't. Only one in 10 with a concussion will lose consciousness.
That's Vicky Evans. She's an associate for the Faculty of Health at UTS and the clinical nurse consultant for neuroscience at the Royal North Shore Hospital.
Basically, a concussion is a knock to the head. Some sort of acceleration, deceleration injury has occurred, and the brain essentially has been shaken up. It's a bit like shaking up a lemonade bottle and it gets all fizzy inside. If you take the top off, it'll explode. But if you just leave it settle, it should calm down.
Concussion has both short and long-term effects. Just after a concussion, you may feel confused or dazed, have blurred vision, a headache, feel nauseous, or even feel more emotional than normal. But the long-term effects of concussion are where it gets more serious. The ones most at risk to these long-term effects are sports players.
If you've had one concussion, you're more easier to get a second one. And the second one will take longer to recover. So it's the compounding effects. If you look at our AFL players or rugby league players and those sort of players, that they're in contact sports week after week, multiple times a week sometimes, and they get those knocks. And, you know, you're at home watching it on the television, you're at the sidelines, and there's a lot of times where you think, oh, my goodness.
Cumulative concussion trauma can make you more susceptible to Alzheimer's, long-term memory loss, dementia, and depression. For sports players, Vicky says there are a number of concussive traumas to be aware of.
There's this other thing called second impact syndrome. It's where somebody gets a concussion and they go back to play the same day and they get a second concussion without the first one having resolved. So the already traumatised brain gets traumatised again, and there's a rapid rise in the pressure inside the person's head, and they can die on the field.
Vicky authored a paper on recognising and managing concussion in school sport. She found a number of similarities between managing the risk of concussion on both the professional football field and the school oval. She found it's the coaches who play a crucial role in dealing with concussion.
The team is only as good as the players, but the players are only as good as their coach. And when coaches are on the sidelines and they do look at the play, they can see, and they're on the first line management, they can see, okay, this child is, or this young adult has had a knock. Let's watch him for a minute, let's take him off and examine him a bit further.
Today, more and more sports players are being made aware of the effects of concussion. This has seen sporting codes in Australia strengthen, with many clubs and teams now adopting a concussion management plan to look after their players.
Rugby union, rugby league, all these ones have adopted things pretty much from 2012, but it's being re-looked at over the last few years, where they do have a play. So they rely on their managers and coaches to look at some sort of memory tool, get the players to fill out, it's called the SCAT, three we're up to now, so looking at the sports concussion recognition tool and looking at how the player thinks, what their short-term memory is like, and doing it before they start the play. And then if they get injured, doing it again and seeing the difference. And then doing it again at the end of the season and looking at the differences. So there's memory recall, there's balance testing, there's just orientation questions in there as well. So this is adopted Australia-wide now and pretty much around the world.
There are a number of concussion-related head traumas that sports players can be subject to. David Thorpe is a lecturer in sports law at UTS. David recently authored an article on helmets raising the risk of brain injury and was talking about one trauma in particular called CTE.
CTE is the initials of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So this is a build-up of the protein called tau, which is naturally occurring in the brain but seems to accelerate in production following multiple head trauma. And with this overproduction of tau, it seems to wrap around the connective tissue between neurons and affects the proper function of the brain.
Similar to the high collision sports here in Australia, like the AFL, there is serious risk for head damage or concussion in the American National Football League. But where in other sports you might use a helmet as a means of protection, in the American NFL, the helmet takes on another role.
When people wear a helmet, and if you watch the NFL, the US National Football League, it's quite obvious that the head is used, or the helmet is used, as a weapon. Often this is used in tackling. It's often used when a player is running with the ball. If you watch the games, you'll see that players will tackle helmet to helmet. They'll put the helmet in front of the running legs of an attacking player. What this suggests is because the helmet offers a level of protection to the external areas of the head, you're not going to feel the pain very much. And although you can still get a heavy blow to the helmet, you can still be concussed, it's quite possible that you don't feel the multiple small shocks.
There are a number of NFL sports players, David says, who are now paying the price from matches they played over 20 years ago.
So in the first case ever brought against the NFL for CTE by the family of Mike Webster, a man who died at the age of 50, he was given in testimony that he probably received something like 25,000 violent head hits in his 17-year career. So people aren't going to do that. You know, it hurts to be hit in the head if you're not wearing a helmet. In another study, 2014, by the US Journal of Neurosurgery, 1,800 college American football players wore sensors in their helmets. And over a five-year period, there were 1.2 million head impacts recorded.
Especially in football culture, aggression and force are prized qualities of the player. Also, there's egging on from the crowd, from the other players, and even the coaches can play their part. But the culture of football, David says, isn't the sole reason behind players experiencing concussion.
There's certainly an aggressive culture in many of the contact sports. You wouldn't play it unless you had some level of aggression. But players aren't silly. They're not going to bang their head if they can avoid doing so. And if it hurts, it's self-regulating. So players just don't do that. You're trained as a rugby player to put your head to the side of the moving legs when tackling. Things go wrong sometimes. There's a shoulder to the head. There's a tackle gone wrong where the head makes contact with the knee of the opponent. A whole range of things. So there are inherent risks. You just cannot get rid of the risk. It's just the nature of the game.
David Thorpe, lecturer in sports law at the University of Technology, Sydney. Vicky Evans agrees that you can't escape the risks entirely and that we shouldn't discourage our young sports players from doing what they love.
Look, everybody plays sports. Every Australian plays sports worldwide, and we shouldn't be stopping that. Sport is very healthy for you, but at the same time we need to realise that it can be a bit of an issue with regards to looking after the brain, and we need to make sure that our kids are not only educated in the best way to play the sport, but also the best way to look after themselves. And that includes things like exercise, building up those neck muscles in particular, the right way to play, and also, it sounds funny, but also teach them sportsmanlike behaviour.
Vicky Evans, Associate Professor from the Faculty of Health at UTS and Clinical Nurse Consultant at the Royal North Shore Hospital, ending that story by Jake Morecambe. You're listening to Think Health on 2SER. Coming up next, the dangers of giving children the wrong drugs in hospital.
The Loft Bar at UTS on Broadway invites the moustache, bearded, goateed and sideburned to celebrate all things hairy in support of Movember.
Join the 5 million Mo Bros and Mo Sisters from around the world raising awareness and money for men's health. You and your spectacular facial hair could win a professional close shave and trim with Sterling Apothecary. Movember, all through November at the Loft Bar UTS on Broadway. The Loft UTS sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Welcome back to Think Health. I'm Ellen Lee Beter. Giving patients drugs is a key part of a nurse's job, but it can also be dangerous. Patients have to be given the right drug, the right amount of the drug, at the right time. It's particularly difficult in children's wards because of the different amounts of drugs needed compared to adults, and because children can't speak up if they are getting the wrong drug. A new trial is being undertaken at the Children's Hospital at Westmead to try and reduce the amount of drug errors in paediatrics. It involves methods such as medication trolleys and more parent involvement. Val Wilson and Laura Johnston joined us to explain why we need to reduce drug errors.
Hi, my name is Val Wilson and I'm Professor of Nursing Research and Practice Development at UTS and Sydney Children's Hospitals Network.
Hi, my name's Laura Johnston. I am a registered nurse at the Children's Hospital at Westmead.
So what exactly is a drug error?
We're talking about children here, and so an error occurs when the child gets either the wrong drug, maybe it's given in the wrong way, it's maybe given at the wrong time, and so an error then occurs because the child's either maybe not got the drug at all or has been given the wrong drug or the wrong dose of the drug.
I understand that drug errors are higher in paediatrics than they are in adult wards. Can you explain why?
I think that there are probably a lot of reasons as to why they're higher in paediatrics. With children, there are many different ways that you can give medication. So whereas in adults, you know, we're more likely to give them a tablet or two tablets, whereas in children we have liquids and we have sachets of granules and we have tablets, it can be crushed or given whole. So I think that there are many different avenues, or there are many different ways that errors can occur in peds more so. And children can't tell you when something is wrong, whereas adults can say, oh, you know, this doesn't really look like what I usually get, or this isn't the amount that I usually get, whereas children don't have, depending on their age, don't have the ability to do that.
When you're talking about, you've got to measure out different, you know, levels of drugs, the weight, is that because the measurements aren't there in front of you as a nurse, or is it just nurse error not seeing the right levels?
It can depend. So when we're doing medications, it's usually two registered nurses that will check it. So in that situation, then we're trying to reduce the errors by having two nurses check it. But there are lots of things that come into play when you are checking drugs. You know, it can be really busy on the ward. It could be really, you know, there are lots of things that come into play.
So I think one of the things that Laura's talking about is that you have to make the calculations. The child is very small, so instead of it being one dose, one tablet, one ampule, you're actually having to make a calculation and a fraction of that. And to increase safety in paediatrics, we have two people checking every drug. The complexity comes in, as she says, when it's very busy, it's hectic, drugs are all given at the same time. They're prepared in a medication room and they're taken to the bed. And that in itself creates a potential error because you could give it to the wrong patient. But in that medication room, what we found is there can be four, five, six people all in there doing the drugs at the same time, double checking, talking over the top of one another. It's noisy, it's hectic, it's busy. It's easy to see how errors could occur. We've looked at the process of medication administration. And, you know, from the time the drug is prescribed to the child gets it, there's something like 50 different steps to ensure that you get it to the right patient at the right time in the right way. So there's opportunities all the way along there to break that sequence.
You said that there's 50 steps in the process from when that medication is prescribed to when the child gets it. What are some of those steps?
Well, if you can imagine, it starts with the doctor seeing the patient, deciding they need a drug. So they've got to think of what that drug is, the patient's weight, what's the drug for, what dose will they give. So, for example, if the patient's weight's not accurate, there's already a potential for the doctor to write or prescribe something. Now, in adult world, it's not such an issue. But in paediatric world, if you imagine a small baby, there's quite a difference between a baby who's 3 kilos and a baby who's 4 kilos. And that in itself, if the weight is not put down correctly, can then lead to a prescription error. The doctor might write it wrongly. They might write it illegibly. If there's a decimal point there, they might not put the decimal point in clearly enough, and so it can be read, and sometimes tenfold errors can occur. So that's in the prescribing. In the dispensing, in pharmacy, they might dispense the wrong drug or the wrong dilution of the drug, or it might be labelled wrongly. So these are all things before it even gets to the ward that can add to it. And then, of course, in the ward, it can be the check-in process that falls down. One nurse says it's X drug. The other nurse doesn't really look at the chart properly. So it doesn't actually check. And the first nurse might have got the drug wrong. So instead of it being ampicillin, it's flucloxacillin. And they're different. They're antibiotics, but they do different things. So that could lead potentially to an error.
Is your research primarily looking at the administration phase of those 50 steps? Or are you looking at it across the whole spectrum?
There's been a lot of research in this area, and there's been a lot of work done on electronic prescribing and trying to improve, if you like, transcription errors. Certainly, if we look at dispensing, there's been a lot around electronic mechanisms for dispensing. And that area has actually improved quite dramatically. But we still persist with administration errors. And so it's a really tough nut to crack. And I think partly because it's about people changing their mindset. They give out drugs very frequently in the clinical setting. And we actually, we've monitored how often they're giving out drugs. So an individual nurse may be given 40 or 50 drugs in a shift. That's a lot. If you imagine they've got to be double-checked, that's like 100. And so it becomes kind of routine and ritual, and people just do. And the need to get things done. And so what we're really talking about is changing people's mindset and being more conscious to what they're doing and changing behaviour patterns. There's certain behaviour patterns that come in a ward that may actually impact on the safety that we need to be aware of. And so that's partly what we're doing, is raising people's awareness to what's happening in their everyday practice.
What sort of steps are you rolling out that you're hoping will reduce the amount of drug errors?
I think on the ward, we're bringing out, we have new electronic, as Val was saying, electronic administration that will be coming out, rolling out sometime next year. But on the wards, we are going to bring in what we call medication trolleys that hopefully will change the way that we're giving medication. So it's happening at the bedside, not somewhere else, and we're bringing it to them. And in that situation, then we'll hopefully be involving the parents a lot more, the parents who are at home giving their child's medications more so than we are, so they're a lot more familiar.
So it's having the parent as an advocate.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Which we've had some issues with trying to get them involved, but hopefully we are pushing to get them more involved with this new system that's coming out, so that we can use them and use their knowledge with their child or whoever they're caring for.
And I think adding to that, I mean, people listening might think, medication trolleys, didn't we used to do that? And of course we did. And that's where nurses went round and went to the bedside and chatted to the patient and gave the drugs.
So is that to reduce the patient getting someone else's drugs?
Yes, exactly. And we used to do that, but then we went away from having a centralised system and having a nurse responsible for individual patients and they did the drugs. We're still going to do that, but we're going to use trolleys as a mechanism for being at the bedside to do it. So rather than the really busy, hectic medication room, we'll have trolleys and three teams of nurses with trolleys going round, and it will mean we're able to invite the parents in more, because it's not that parents don't want to be involved, it's sometimes that the way we practice excludes them. So for example, if we prepare the drug in the medication room, they don't see that and they're just handed something to give to the child. They're not being part of the process. They don't even get to ask questions, if you like. Whereas if we're at the bedside, they can be involved, they can ask questions, they can check things out. And we think that that will increase not only the safety for the child, but it will increase the ability for the parent to be part of the process. we're not saying that's going to be easy, because already nurses are thinking about, oh, well, it's going to take me more time. I'm going to, you know, I have to explain everything to the parents. So there are already some issues that we're working through. But at the same time, I think it's been positively received.
Finally, this is a trial that is just happening in Westmead Hospital. Are there plans for it to go further?
Absolutely, and we share the results as we go through, and there's already been changes that have occurred in the hospital because of some of the things that we've found out. So there's been changes to a couple of policies and one of the practice areas that's changed throughout the hospital, not just in Clancy, because of some of the evidence we unearthed. So the idea for us is testing it out in one clinical area because we can be quite intensive there, but then rolling out the ideas to other areas. I've talked about the research in many of the places I've visited overseas and in Australia, and everywhere I go, everyone's trying to crack this to make things better. And so we hope that we have lots of useful results that will help others even think about their practice.
Val Wilson from UTS and the Sydney Children's Hospital Network, and Laura Johnston from the Children's Hospital at Westmead. Here on 2SER, you're listening to Think Health. Up next, we discuss the complexities of living with chronic back pain.
University of Technology Sydney postgrad info sessions are on now. Talk to course leaders in law, psychology, business, health, architecture and animation, pharmacy, orthoptics, IT, communication, education, engineering, data science and innovation, and much more. Get course and sessions info at postgraduate.uts.edu.au. Own the knowledge. Own your future. UTS sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're listening to Think Health on 2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome back to Think Health on 2SER. Lower back pain is the largest cause of disability in the Western world. Up to 80% of us will experience it at some point in our lives. Causes can vary, but there is no doubt that it has a debilitating and frustrating impact on your everyday life. But for those people diagnosed with chronic lower back pain, finding the appropriate treatment can be tricky, and it can be even more difficult to cope with the psychological impact on your well-being. Jake Morecambe explains.
In Australia, it costs over $4.8 billion in healthcare costs per year. So low back pain can affect anyone from children through to older people.
That's Dr. Craig Moore. He's a PhD student in the Faculty of Health at UTS and chiropractor at Crow's Nest Chiropractic Centre.
And in fact, the most common cause of low back pain tends to relate to how we inadvertently place pressure and load on our discs or our joints. So we call these biomechanical risks, or biomechanical risk factors that will lead to a sudden episode of acute low back pain. So I guess I'm mostly talking about prolonged sitting, bending, twisting the back, or awkward postures, or heavy manual activities. Those sorts of biomechanical risk factors that put an inappropriate load on our discs or joints. And then there's other individual risks as well, and that might relate to their age, or if they're overweight, or if they've got poor health and poor fitness, those sorts of risks.
But sometimes the problem is when the pain becomes much more intense. This is called chronic pain. And for those who experience chronic low back pain, it can be incredibly unpleasant.
So a percentage of people who have an acute episode of low back pain, they can go on to suffer chronic low back pain. So that's defined as low back pain that's lasted for 3 months or more. So we would call that chronic low back pain. Some people go on to have recurrent low back pain, which means they continue to have relapses of shorter episodes. So those are the more complex cases and the more challenging ones. So while the average person, their low back pain might typically resolve within a matter of weeks, with or without a minimum amount of treatment, some people go on to suffer ongoing chronic low back pain, and they're the more challenging cases.
As Craig has said, many seek treatment to deal with the burden of low back pain. There are a number of options, all depending on the severity of the pain experienced. This could be a short course of spinal manipulation with a chiropractor, certain prescriptions, or even encouragement to stay upright and active as opposed to laying down. However, Craig says there are a few myths to debunk when it comes to treating low back pain.
We've learnt now that paracetamol is quite ineffective in the treatment of acute low back pain, and there was a major study published fairly recently in the British Medical Journal, which did a review of all of the research that was looking at how effective Panadol was for acute low back pain, and they found it was no better than placebo.
And not only are paracetamols ineffective for treating low back pain, according to Craig, x-rays are unnecessary too.
And that's been a challenge because many of the guidelines now are encouraging doctors and chiropractors and physiotherapists to really hold back on imaging, whether it's x-rays or MRI scans. For the fairly common type of low back pain, x-rays, for example, are very unhelpful. They don't tend to change the type of treatment that's going to be offered. And so this is a challenge. It's been a challenge for changing the habits of doctors and chiropractors and physios who may in the past have very frequently referred a patient for an x-ray. And it's also a challenge for a lot of the public who walk into the office of a healthcare professional and they're sort of expecting that they'll have an x-ray and thinking that they need an x-ray. And sometimes we have to even convince the patient that they don't need an x-ray.
Any experience of pain can dramatically alter your behaviour. If the pain extends over a period of time, you can become antsy, frustrated, upset, or even depressed. Toby Newton-John is a senior lecturer and clinical psychologist at the UTS Graduate School of Health. He says that pain and emotion are more closely linked than you think.
The best way to start thinking about that one is to sort of go back and think of, you know, what's the purpose of pain? Why do we have pain? Of course, that relates to this sort of evolutionary idea that pain is a way of alerting us to the fact that something is going wrong in our body somewhere or potentially going wrong, and that we need to do something about it. So it's got two components. One is the detection component, that your brain perceives that there's something happening in your body which is not good for it. And then secondly, that your brain kind of motivates you to get away from that input or that source or that kind of noxious stimulation, as it's called. Even in some cases, very rapid. If you put your hands, you know, accidentally on the stove or against the hot iron, you know, your hand comes off that stove before you've even almost registered that it touched it. But if the long-term pain, this pain that goes on day after day, if the person isn't able to get away from that pain, if they're not able to find a treatment that fixes it or it doesn't go away by itself, you start to get the picture of where the psychological distress around pain starts, because in effect, you have a brain which is telling you constantly, you need to do something to make this pain stop. And the person very often is doing their very best to try, and they're seeing all the doctors and taking the tablets and doing all the treatments, but it's not stopping. There's a fundamental frustration there.
Finding a way to deal with both the physical pain and emotional strain of chronic lower back pain, Toby says, isn't all black and white.
My sense is that most would say, in answer to that question, they would say, if somebody can fix my pain problem, that in itself will take away all the psychological difficulties that I have. The frustration, the depression, the lack of sleep, the irritability, the anxiety about the future, all of those emotions are related to my daily experience of pain. And if that can be fixed for me, the other difficulties will sort of fall away. So people do tend to look for a fairly straightforward biological approach. You know, they have an operation, or they have an injection of some kind, or they have some kind of medication or medication combination. And if those treatments work, that's fabulous. And if that gets rid of that pain, all well and good. But unfortunately, for about 20% of the adult population, their pain doesn't go away. It's a persistent problem. For that group, about 10% of them are really significantly disabled by their pain. And that's where a sort of multidisciplinary approach, where there's support around some of the biological options there, but also support for managing the pain as an ongoing problem is the ideal version.
Jake Morecambe with that report. If you'd like to find out more about that story or listen to any of our past programs, head to our website at 2ser.com/thinkhealth. This show is produced with the support of the University of Technology Sydney Faculty of Health. Please remember that you should not consider the contents of this show medical advice, and you should consult your physician if you have any concerns. I'm Ellen Liebeder. This has been Think Health. See you next week for more in health research and news.